This morning I want to preach a sermon on what makes for a great church. We are kicking off what ought to be an upbeat, vigorous period here at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Fullerton, with multiple opportunities to become a healthier, stronger community, to refine some of our systems, and eventually, there's really no great rush on this, but probably in about 18 months, settle a new minister, or call a new minister, and then there's a few months of getting ready for that person to come. In conjunction with that search, this congregation will, sometime in the late summer or early fall of 2015, embark on a major self-survey. Things are clearly in transition. Consequently, today, it seems to me, is a good time to ask, well, what are we doing here? Let me take this morning to tell you what I think you're doing here, or at least trying to do, to nurture and keep alive a thriving, truly creative, and actually really liberal Unitarian Universalist congregation here in Northern Orange County. Well, what is the key to such a community, or what are the keys? What will enable our efforts to flourish? I think there are four ingredients, four dimensions. When I started thinking about this years ago, the image that initially came to mind was that of a four-cylinder internal combustion engine, an engine in which, when it's functioning properly, all four pistons are moving smoothly and in sync. In those years when I was in seminary, I had a little old 122S bulb, and I was constantly trying to make that thing go, so I thought about this a lot. A few years later, in the early 90s, I came across the image on the cover of today's Order of Service, discovered in a book by the Reverend Dick Gilbert, Minister Emeritus of New York's First Unitarian Church. I'll employ the mechanical four-cylinder engine metaphor some, but mostly Reverend Gilbert's wheel image throughout my remarks this morning. The four-cylinder engine model makes sense in that automobiles have many parts and many subsystems that all need to be in proper tune for the engine to run smoothly. From time to time, one subsystem, the electrical system, something about the timing or what have you, gets out of whack. So the mechanic, the minister, tinkers with things until he or she gets it all running smoothly again, at which point some other part could probably use their attention. When everything's working perfectly, even if only for a short time, the congregations can really hum. People are joining, programs expanding, and the coffers are full. A good minister keeps at it without too much anxiety, believing that his or her hard work will eventually bear fruit. But like the good mechanic, one has to keep paying attention by checking in, listening, and keeping everything well oiled. Now let us consider Dick Gilbert's wheel. At the center, worship and the celebration of life. Well, let's start right there, worship. Worship's one of those words that some Unitarian Universalists struggle with. But the etymology of the word, as I understand it, is worth-ship, the act of making or remaking worthy. Archaeologists and anthropologists describe the content of ancient worship as ritual and as dance. This is where religion probably began, celebrating shared joy with song and music. The single most frequently mentioned aspect in common among growing churches is that they're festive. They celebrate coming-of-age ceremonies, honoring elders, anniversaries of important congregational milestones, what are we celebrating? Ultimately, it seems to me, our connections to one another. The great turn-of-the-century Oxford classicist Jane Ellen Harrison used to quote Aeschylus, the Greek dramatist and poet, in claiming that ritual was one of humanity's three great inventions: fire, habitations, dwelling places, and ritual, worship. A people's educational and cultural values are passed on in worship by way of ritual. So worship, essentially, and I'll return to this theme periodically. In fact, next week I'm going to talk about the value of ritual and how ritual can heal and open up consciousness and all kinds of things next week. But for now, let's just think of it as celebrating our connectedness to each other, to the culture, the tradition, and also to something even deeper, which I'm going to call the deep self, or the capital S self. There's an ancient myth that gives us a clue to the deeper connections that rituals can and sometimes do get us in touch with. And this myth is in about 200 different cultures, but I'm just going to call it, from an Egyptian one, the myth of the mad king. There's just variations on this theme. But here's the basic story. Once upon a time, a great sovereign sends his child on an important secret mission. The youth is to go to Egypt, blend in, mingle with the people, and await further instructions. So the young person obeys, journeying abroad to that ancient land, finding a place to live and a trade, and settling down. To become fully integrated into the life there, the child learns the language, makes friends, finds a spouse, and starts a family. Moreover, life is good. In time, our hero all but forgets about the mission. Indeed, were it not for occasional dreams and vague memories, she would have forgotten altogether. It goes on like this for a long time until one evening on her way home, a man in uniform introduces himself as an emissary from her father, the king. "It is now time to return home," he explains. "Follow me." Confused by the abruptness and total unexpectedness of the encounter, she dismisses the man, but moments later, retracing her steps in search of him, he has vanished. Except for, is it his business card lying here on the street? A note on the back of which reads, "Your heart knows the way. Follow it home." The ancient world organized social life to ensure that we all got word from our homeland and started back to regain our rightful throne. This process is called initiation. Initiation into the deeper mind, our collective unconscious, or to use Ralph Waldo Emerson, the Unitarian's term, into our true, or capital S, self, our deep self, our soul. Some years ago, while serving a church in suburban Pittsburgh, I led an adult religious education program called The Canticle of the Sun, in which we watched and discussed a 12-part video series narrated by the mathematical cosmetologist Brian Swim. In it, Swim describes the human condition in the language of cosmology, quantum physics, biological science, and traditional wisdom. The Earth, he declares, is an intelligent, self-regulating planet, and we, human beings, are products of this earth. Let us for a moment consider that image, that new image that Swim proposes, and contrast it with the biblical image many of us grew up with, and then contrast that biblical image of who we are with the understandings of Brian Swim and other scientists some of whom have actually are quite open to mystical ideas that also informed the transcendentalists like Emerson, Whitman, and Margaret Fuller. The old image of human beings is that of heaven-sent strangers on earth who, after suffering nobly through this mortal coil, are released, if they've been good, and returned to their rightful home in heaven. But this image is hopelessly out of date, for the truth, as Brian Swim and others have pointed out, we don't come into this world at all. We come out of it. The new image of humanity is as a natural product of the earth. For indeed, as Alan Watts once observed, our earth is peopling. Just as the apple tree, apples, and the vine, grapes, our earth is peopling. If we are intelligent beings, then we are the products of an intelligent earth, symptomatic of an intelligent energy system. For you can't gather figs from thistles or grapes from thorns. Some people, I suppose, never come to this insight. Others do, but uncertain and unsupported in its meaning, dismiss it. Nevertheless, it can be nurtured, and that's what worship is all about, nurturing our connections, including the deep internal connection to the creative heart of life, the self, the still small inner voice, the heart of hearts, the Atman, that is Brahman, the still small point at the seat of the soul. Say something spiritual. I am forever being petitioned. Something intellectually stimulating, something that's hopeful, that's emotionally honest, and also, oh yes, up to date. All this, honestly, I do try to do. All ministers do. But whatever we say, it has also got to touch the wellsprings, or folks will eventually find something else to do with their Sunday mornings. So, worship and celebration at the center. At the heart of what we do, the taproot. The outer circle, however, is just as important. Note that in this image of a healthy congregation, all four components of a healthy church touch each other and the other three. In other words, all these aspects of congregational life link with one another, influence one another, connect with the other three. What does this mean? Well, consider a second element of a healthy church, caring community. Members support one another, take care of one another in crisis, and behave like, often as, a group of loving friends. Here at UUCF, we have an excellent Sunshine Committee. Indeed, you've done a very good job of organizing yourselves to look after one another, make regular calls on shut-ins, and fill in the gap between a get-well card and a visit from the minister at the hospital. Being a truly caring community also means being non-judgmental and understanding of another's views, ideas, and, within reason, lifestyle. Healthy congregations are communities where we nourish one another despite our political differences, bind up the wounds of our defeats, and share our joys, both personal and social. In 1983, the Rochester Unitarian Church voted 156-1 to endorse the nuclear freeze. In his newsletter column, Reverend Gilbert wrote a column, Note to a Minority of One, paying tribute to the woman, apparently everyone knew who she was, who had cast the dissenting vote. Her courage, Dick wrote, serves to remind the majority that conscience counts for something in liberal congregations and in our liberal faith. The caring and the ethical are one, as we see in the image where they touch each other, for, as I pointed out earlier, all four components of a healthy church are interrelated and interconnected. The third piston of our well-tuned congregational engine is religious education. By religious education, I mean more than just Sunday school. I mean a lifespan community of religious learning and growth. The main ingredient here is attitude. I'm reminded of a self-portrait at age 80 by this Spanish romantic painter and printmaker, Francisco de Goya. It shows the aged artist walking with two canes and is entitled, "I Am Still Learning." Francisco de Goya's attitude is the attitude we seek to foster here, an attitude that we can still learn, and that we can learn to see a religious dimension in all the situations we're learning about. Moreover, we can help one another model this attitude for our children and youth, and include our young people in other aspects of congregational life, in our celebrations, and in our social justice projects. Here, social justice is the fourth dimension of a healthy congregation: moral discourse and action. A few years back, I co-taught a class at one of our UUA summer institutes. The class was titled Social Action in the Local Congregation. One of the participants, Carolyn, was a strong Unitarian Universalist from one of the district's suburban and fairly affluent congregations. At the week's beginning, Carolyn was adamant in her conviction that social action only created divisions within congregations. By the week's end, she felt completely different. The problem at her home church, as she eloquently expressed the last day, was that the social activists tended to act independently, off on their own. What she wanted was for them to be in dialogue with the whole congregation so that everyone was talking about how to be better, more wholesome people, and helping each other learn new ways to be better people. Carolyn's initial feelings were not all that far off base, however. Too many Unitarian Universalist congregations are somewhat politically knee-jerk and not safe for those who don't share the majority view. But today, I am purposefully not focusing on ways in which our congregations occasionally fall short. I'm talking about something else, about religious communities that are not indoctrinating or neutral, and not political propaganda stations for the latest social action fad either. To be a true church, the church must seek to penetrate the social order with justice. But at the same time, it must not itself be co-opted into any political party or social movement. Any church worth its name will include ethical reflection as a central part of its raison d'etre. In such a congregation, moral discourse is carried out in pew and pulpit, classroom and coffee hour, in office and in seminar. It draws on historical for instances of ethical reflection and behavior. It delineates the moral traditions in which our movement stands. So how do we get there? How do we focus and continually refocus our energies here at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Fullerton so that we're running at full horsepower? Let me propose the following. First, remember to keep Sunday morning celebrative and worship full. I've heard from a few people who have shared with me some of their hopes for worship here on Sunday during the coming year or two. I must tell you, I've been flattered, really, to be engaged by these people so earnestly. Not everybody agreeing with everything either, but just committed to talking about it. Now, not everyone has agreed completely with even the modest changes I've already made to the order of service. Others have said they like them. Either way, your passion has forced me to articulate, next week I'll speak on this subject alone, as clearly as I can my understanding of what worship in a liberal church is designed to do. People want to be fed and inspired on Sunday. And we Unitarian Universalists have just the message, I believe, and just the sacred circle in which to do it. Second, whatever else we do, let us strive always to care for one another, even the one among us with an iconoclastic point of view. Third, we have to keep our commitment to religious education high for all of us, but especially for our young people. And finally, we have to be comfortable recognizing that there is an ethical dimension to every decision we make. Let this place be one where we can struggle together to figure out what the most moral choices would be and to support one another in making them. Here at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Fullerton, we are well on our way. But there is a ways to go, too. In the wake of the radical religious right's many successes over the last 30 years, we will have to be more focused and determined, wise as serpents and gentle as doves, if we want to articulate clearly an alternative message, one that's radical and caring, liberating and wholesome, regarding what congregational life is and can be all about. Please, over the coming months, won't you join me in bringing that model to fruition here in Orange County? Thank you. And may it be so. Shalom, shalom, namaste, blessed be.